House will come to order. The clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Here. Barnhart. Berger. Beyer. Bonamici. Here. Boone. Boquist. Bruin. Buckley. Burley. Butler. Cameron. Cannon. Clem. Here. Cowan. Here. Dallum. Here. Dingfelder. Chris Edwards. David Edwards. Esquivel. Flores. Galizio. Gerard. Gelzer. Gilliam. Gilman. Gerard. Greenlick. Hannah. Holvey. Hunt. Jensen. Comp. Kotek. Krieger. Crummel. Lim. McPherson. Maurer. Minnis. Morgan. Nathanson. Nelson. Nolan. Olson. Reed. Richardson. Riley. Roblin. Rosenbaum. Schaffler. Scott. Shields. Greg Smith. Patty Smith. Thatcher. Tomei. Wisnet. Witt. Mr. Speaker. Excused. Burley. Tomei. Excused for business. Berger. Buckley. Esquivel. Hunt. Rosenbaum. Roblin. Thatcher.
Flag salute will be led by Representative Jeff Barker.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The opening ceremony will be presented by Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Morning, everyone. Okay, we'll try it one more time. Good morning, everyone. Okay. Hey, I just want to leave a thought with you and then pray with you together this morning. The secret of contentment is the realization that life is a gift, not a right. So let's pray. Lord, we thank you for this day, and we thank you, too, for giving us a new week. Yesterday, Representative Callan and I attended an event for mobilization of another National Guard unit to head back over for their second tour of duty in Iraq. And we can't stop or pass by this moment without lifting up all those families and all those soldiers that are en route over there now. But we also want to pray, too, for all the soldiers throughout our world, God, that are standing up and protecting us as well. pray for this body today and for this week and for the leadership here, Lord, as we close this session over the next several weeks, but that you would grant wisdom to them as well as to all of us now, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
Courtesies. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Sarah Beckers has been an intern in my office over the last 3 months, making a very large contribution, trekking from Corvallis twice a week. She's impressed us with her dedication, her ability to quickly learn and remember details about the legislature, and her eagerness to take on new tasks and responsibilities, including the running the office herself one afternoon when my staff was at an event in district. Sarah came to Oregon from Darmstadt, Germany, to complete her bachelor's degree at the University of Oregon. She pursued this internship to help her learn more about the American political system and Oregon's government in particular. She feels that this has been a very valuable experience and has especially enjoyed learning the vocabulary that is unique to the legislature. Sarah is finishing her degree at Oregon State University this term and will move to the Netherlands in the fall to begin a graduate program in international relations and diplomacy. I expect we may see her back in a different context later. Please join me in wishing her the best of luck in her future endeavors and thanking her for the work she has put in and the contribution she has made to our process here. Thank you, Sarah.
Representative Hanna.
Good morning, colleagues. Thank you. I'm introducing an honorary page this morning, Miss Meredith Loy. Good morning, Meredith. Meredith is from Portland. Her parents are Betty Yada and Michael Loy. Meredith is a fourth grader at St. Thomas More. She plays basketball and she participates with the China Council. Look out, Portlanders. Her career goal is to become a state senator. And she is in the district of Representative Mary Nolan. Good morning, Meredith. Thank you for being here.
We do find it a little questionable in this chamber why you would want to become a state senator rather than a state representative. But we'll forgive you for that. We're delighted to have you. Representative Berger.
Mr. Speaker, I have a number of honorary pages this morning, and if they would stand when they hear their names, we can all get a good look at them. The first is Eddie Gauthier. He's from Independence. He's in the seventh grade. He's at Talmadge Middle School. He, as you can see, is active in the Boy Scouts. And listen to this interesting career goal. He wants to own a hydrogen refinery. I'm going to have to learn a bit before I understand it, but I think it's a lot of a goal, and welcome, Eddie. The next is Trevor Bednarz from Salem. There he is. I happen to know his father. He's in the eighth grade at Howard Street Charter School, which is a great school just south of here. He's active in choir, orchestra, drama, and art, and he wants to be a marine architect. Welcome, Trevor. The next is Jacob Wyant, standing right there in the 10th grade at West Salem High School, right up the street from me. He belongs to the football team, lacrosse team, member of the school symphonic band, and member of the Latin club. He's speaking Latin. Wonderful. And he wants to, his career goal is to be in the medical profession. Welcome, Jacob. Anna Stipe, or is it Stipe? Thank you, Anna. She is from Salem, another West Salem High School 10th grader, 16 years old, member of the school band, science, she likes science and animals, and she belongs to a group called Students for Change and a member of the band council. Her career goal is to become a veterinarian. Welcome, Anna. Walter Moser, am I close, Walter? Moser, thank you. Walter is from Independence, 10th grade, Central High School. You can see he is also very active in the Boy Scouts, and he enjoys playing tennis, and he wants to be a mechanic. Welcome, Walter. The next one is James Sorrells III. He's the son of James Sorrells II, or James Sorrells Jr. He's from Monmouth. He's in the seventh grade at Talmadge Middle School. He likes to play soccer. He's obviously in the Boy Scouts, and he's not quite sure of his career goals. Maybe he'll end up in the House of Representatives, the better house. Then there's Barrett Noosh. I don't know if I'm even close. He's from Independence. He's in the ninth grade at South Salem High School. He's a member of the school orchestra. South Salem, by the way, has an incredibly good music program, as do all Salem schools. And he's in the Boy Scouts, and he, too, is undecided as to what his career goals are. Welcome, Barrett. And last, Chad Boyack. Hope I'm close on that last name, too. He's from Monmouth in the sixth grade. He is homeschooled. Enjoys swimming, church, science, and computers, and obviously also a Boy Scout and unsure about his career goals. I'm really proud, colleagues, to have all of these honorary pages here today. Hope you'll welcome them, and I hope they enjoy their day.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I also would like to identify an honorary page today. Amber Smith, stand up. Amber is the granddaughter of Legislative Assistant Bob Avery. Oh, Bob, okay, shifted on me here all of a sudden. Her hometown is Eugene. She attends Harrisburg Middle School, where she's a sixth grader. She's 11 years old. She is a member of the school band and a member of the Awesome Club. She was previously selected as a student leadership student of the month there, and she wants to own a coffee shop or be a veterinarian. Thank you.
Representative Greg Smith.
Good morning, Mr. Speaker. I have a couple honorary pages I need to introduce. First of all, we have Sean Overbay. Sean, stand on up. Sean is from the great community of North Powder. He's in the seventh grade, and he attends McCain Middle School, which is in Payette, Idaho, which tells you a little bit about the area that we live in. Sean is interested in government, arts, sports, and auto racing. His career goal is he wants to be president of the United States, which I think, coming from Union County, that's quite possible. Thank you, Sean. It's great having you here. And then, Mr. Speaker, I have two other fine young students I need to introduce. While they're not in my district, I've been asked to introduce them. The first is Meredith Loy. Meredith, stand on up. Good morning, Meredith. Meredith is from Portland. Her parents are Betty and Michael. She's 10 years old, and she's in the fourth grade. She attends St. Thomas More School. She plays basketball, and she participates on the Northwest China Council. Her career goal is to be a state senator. I don't know who's bringing these folks here, but I'm going to come talk to you. And she is the constituent of the great Representative Mary Nolan. We also have another honorary page I'd like to introduce, and that's Jonathan Jonas. Jonathan, stand on up. Scout. Jonathan is from Monmouth. He's 12 years old, and he's in the fifth grade. And Jonathan plays the piano, and he's on the school swim team, and he's also a Boy Scout. He's not sure what he wants to do with his career. And colleagues, he is the constituent of Representative Brian Boquist. Jonathan, it's great having you here. And then just very quickly, Mr. Speaker, I just want to point out very quickly that the LeGrand Tigers rule, and we shall be talking about that in remonstrances. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I appreciate being recognized a second time. Is Nell Gale here? Nell, thank you for being here today. Nell is from Eugene. She is an eighth grader at Roosevelt Middle School. And is on the yearbook staff. She belongs to the band festival and is involved with drama. Her career goals involve journalism. We have a love-hate relationship with journalism here, but we hope that we'll love what you do. And thank you very much for being a page with us today.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I hope that you will join me in welcoming another honorary page. Parker, would you stand up, please? Parker Williams is from Philomath, Oregon, where she is a student at Philomath Middle School. Parker is part of the leadership class, a member of the student council. She is on the honor roll, and she is an office assistant, and recently she was named Student of the Month. She is the daughter of Donna and the Honorable Judge Locke Williams from the Benton County Circuit Court, and her career goals include becoming possibly an elementary school teacher. Welcome to the Capitol today, Parker. I hope you enjoy your day.
For their courtesies, messages from the governor.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the Governor to reform duties, approve and sign the following bills: House Bill 2053, 2066, 2068, 2069, 2074, 2101, 2154, 2169, 2218, 2219, 2221, 2224, 2250, 2253, 2254, 2255, 2259, 2260, 2287, 2289, 2318, 2362, 2366, 2379, 2385, 2423, 2490, 2579, 2668, 2669, 2675, 2729, 2741, 2756, 2773, 2782, 2826, 2869, 2906, 2970, 3068, 5015, 5027, 5028, 5029, 5030, 5042, 5030, 5051, 2092, 2240.
Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to reform the Senate has passed House Bills 2485, 2622, 2704, 2758, 2785, 2913, 3313, 3337, 3400, 3445, 3527, adopted HJM 13, passed the following House bills as amended by the Senate. House Bills 3484, 2107, 2117, 2204, 2473, 2478, 2538, 2910, 3116, 135, 38, 2256. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to reform that he has signed Senate Bill 751, 734, 596, 592, 277, 206, 175, 173, 73, 59, SJR 19. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform that he has signed House Bills 2162, 2225, 2226, 2438, 2445, 2507, 2517, 2290, 3354, 3360. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform that he has signed House Bills 2184 and 2626.
First reading, memorials and resolutions. Standing committee reports. Committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports. Propositions and motions. Representative Cannon.
Mr. Speaker, I move the House concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2213 and repass the bill.
Representative Cannon moves the House concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2213 and repass the bill. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, the Senate did two very simple things to House Bill 2213. This bill is the bill that requires insurers to provide a reasonable estimate of out-of-pocket costs to patients before they undergo a specified list of services or treatments at the hospital or at their doctor. It's a good bill, a very good bill. The Senate's amendments simply delay the implementation date by 6 months and change the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services authority slightly, allowing them only to receive, upon request, information related to how insurers determine usual, customary, reasonable cost for out-of-network procedures instead of requiring those methodologies for approval. I'm not thrilled about these amendments, but I don't think it's worth holding up this bill and taking it to conference committee. I urge your aye vote on this concurrence motion. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Cannon, do you wish to close? He does not. Those of the opinion of the House concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2213B will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Shields votes aye. Representative Boone?
I have not seen Boone yet.
Representative Boone, how do you vote? Representative Boone is off the floor. Representative Gelser votes aye. Representative Butler, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Gilliam votes aye. House Bill 2213B, having received a constitutional majority, is declared repassed. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move the House concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2223 and repass the bill.
Representative Schaffler moves the House concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2223B and repass the bill. To your motion.
House Bill 2223B expands the definition of an employer under the Oregon State Employment Act to include a successor employer, which is a business or enterprise that is substantially the same entity as a predecessor employer. This will allow Oregon OSHA to hold successor employers responsible for occupational safety violations if it is substantially the same business. The Senate adopted provisions to ensure that the bill is not applied retroactively and added an emergency clause effective on passage. There is no opposition to the changes. Good bill should pass.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Shuffler, do you wish to close? He does not. Bill's opinion that the House concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2223B and repass the bill will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. All have voted. House Bill 2223B, having received a constitutional majority, is declared repassed. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House not concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2342 and that a conference committee be appointed.
Representative McPherson moves the House not concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2342 and that a conference committee be appointed. To your motion.
Colleagues, this bill makes it a misdemeanor, a Class A misdemeanor, to give false information to a peace officer for citation or for arrest. And it was applied across a range of cases. It's already the law that is such a misdemeanor, but this expanded the circumstances in which the offense would apply, the misdemeanor. And the Senate amendments limit the bill so that it does not apply when there's probable cause to arrest the person who's giving false information about their about who they are, about their identity. And on certain initial investigation with what the thinking was in the Senate side, it wasn't clear just why that change had been made, and I think it bears further explanation. So our recommendation is we have a conference committee as an opportunity to get a handle on that. It may be that the Senate amendment is well crafted and that we'll decide to urge a concurrence when it comes back, but we're not confident of that yet, and so I recommend an aye vote on this non-concurrence motion.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative McPherson, do you wish to close? He does not. Those of the opinion of the House not concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2342 and that a conference committee be appointed will say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion to not concur in the Senate amendments to House Bill 2342 and that a conference committee be appointed is declared adopted. First reading of House bills.
House Bill 3560 relating to construction of bridges.
Bill read first time is passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of House bills.
House Bill 5002 relating to financial administration of the State Department of Agriculture, appropriate money, declare numbers. House Bill 5022 relating to financial administration of the Department of Environmental Quality, appropriate money, declare numbers. House Bill 5023 relating to financial administration of the Department of Environmental Quality, declare numbers. House Bill 5038 relating to financial administration of the Office of Private Health Partnerships, appropriate money, declare numbers. House Bill 2810 relating to tax credits.
Bills read second time are passed the third reading. Consent calendar. Clerk will read the bill in summary.
Senate Bill 153 relating to health insurers and declaring an emergency requires employee benefit plan and health insurer to reimburse state Medicaid expenditures.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 153B. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Butler votes aye. Representative Wisnett votes aye. Representative Clem votes aye. Senate Bill 153B, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Chair requests, we are now in third reading of House bills, and the Chair requests unanimous consent that House Bill 5003 be moved to this afternoon's agenda as the first item of the afternoon agenda. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Clerk, read the next bill.
House Bill 3265, relating to public borrowing and appropriating money.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of House Bill 3265A. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In October 2004, Oregon State Treasurer Randall Edwards and the Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission requested the Oregon Law Commission undertake the revision of the general laws affecting state and local government borrowing that are found in ORS Chapters 286, 287, and 288. The Law Commission approved the request and formed the Government Borrowings Work Group. The Government Borrowings Work Group is chaired by the Oregon Law Commission Chair, Lane Shetterly, who most of you know as the former chair of this body's Revenue Committee. Its members include representatives from the Office of the Oregon State Treasurer, the Oregon Municipal Bond Debt Advisory Commission, the Department of Justice, Oregon State agencies that borrow, Oregon cities, Oregon school districts, nationally recognized bond counsel, academia, financial advisors, and underwriters of Oregon municipal bonds. This bill is a comprehensive revision of state and local government borrowing statutes in those three ORS chapters I referred to. These statutes affect all Oregon governments that borrow money. The Government Borrowing Work Group believes the changes embodied in this bill will make Oregon government borrowing more efficient, reducing unnecessary costs to state agencies, local governments, and Oregon citizens, and so does your Committee on Revenue that passed the bill out to the floor with a do-pass recommendation unanimously. Here's the problem, colleagues. Unlike private entities, state agencies and local governments need very clear authority to borrow money. A borrowing that's done by a state agency or a local government without clear legal authority can be declared void by a court. Purchasers of state and local government bonds protect themselves against this risk by requiring that governments borrowers provide an unqualified legal opinion that borrowing is authorized. The lawyer who gives these opinions, usually described as nationally recognized bond counsel, are able to give unqualified opinions on borrowings only if there is no substantial doubt about that the borrowing is authorized. Because of the risk that the bond could be declared void by a court, the need for unqualified opinion, there is a significant and, colleagues, unnecessary cost to the state and local governments if the statutes are ambiguous or inconsistent. For the last 30 years, the Oregon Legislative Assembly has been adding bits and pieces to the three chapters I referred to. The chapters lack generally applicable definitions, and terms in these statutes are often used inconsistently. A word may mean something in one place and something different in another. Particular government bodies are occasionally left out because of drafting inconsistencies, and it's growing harder and harder to determine how different sections of these chapters relate to each other. Legislation that originally began with notwithstanding any other provision of law or that otherwise overrode inconsistent prior legislation has been codified without those overrides, and the inconsistent statutes have, in some cases, been subsequently amended, making it even more difficult to determine what these statutes mean. So you can see there is a very large need for a major revision of Oregon's bond statutes. So the project that they engaged in established ORS 286 as the chapter with the general bonding provisions that relate to state borrowings. Clarify that all state borrowings are issued by the state treasurer. Believe it or not, that was not true, is not true under current statutes. Clarifying the responsibilities of state agencies in connection with state borrowings, and streamlining the process for state borrowings by eliminating unnecessary formal requirements for the state treasurer review of state borrowings. The next chapter, ORS 287, contains the general borrowing provisions that relate to local government borrowings and clarifying how those provisions relate to each other. We save an entire ORS chapter, colleagues, with this bill by repealing Chapter 288, whose provisions are incorporated in the other two chapters. We have modernized and simplified the language and definitions, eliminated inconsistencies and references to outdated and unnecessary requirements, make the financing techniques currently available in these chapters broadly available to all state agencies and local governments unless there is a sound policy reason for denying those techniques to particular governments. It grants the state treasurer more authority to adopt rules affecting state and local borrowing and greater flexibility to impose fees for services provided by the Office of the State Treasurer to borrowing governments. It reforms older statutes that provide in detail how borrowings must be done to give the state treasurer, state agencies, and local governments the ability to adapt the details of borrowings to rapidly evolving public financing markets. This bill does not authorize any new types of borrowing, but it does allow the state and local governments more flexibility when they exercise the powers that the legislature has previously given them so that they can respond to changing market conditions and the cost of borrowing. And colleagues, those are key items. The changing market conditions and the cost of borrowing and simplification are the keys. There are some changes that the bill makes. It is not simply a recodification, and let me list the more important of those changes. Section 5 of the bill gives the state treasurer broader authority to charge state agencies and local governments for services the state treasurer's office provides in connection with the state and local government borrowings. Currently, the state treasurer provides a wide variety of services, but charges for only a few. These provisions are intended to allow the treasurer to charge fees that are commensurate with services given instead of subsidizing services in one area with fees collected in another. Section 7 sub 2 sub G allows the treasurer to invest bond proceeds separately from other money held. By the treasurer. This provision facilitates compliance with federal tax laws and allows investments that support borrowings to be tailored to those borrowings. Section 9 sub 2 changes the state treasurer report that assists the governor in preparing the budget for state borrowings. The change has the state treasurer recommending a prudent maximum amount of borrowings rather than having the treasurer simply consult with and advise the governor. So the treasurer then becomes responsible under this section for telling the governor what is the maximum prudent amount that the state can borrow in the next biennium in the preparation of the budget. Section 9, sub 4, and sub 5 allow the unused bonding authority that the legislature grants to state agencies for a biennium to be used by the agency after the end of the biennium, but only until the legislature acts to set new bonding authority for the agency or the legislature adjourns. And, of course, this, is for simplification, streamlining purposes, and allow for timing of bond sales. Section 29 deletes one of the standards for allocating the private activity.
Representative Richardson, for what purpose do you rise?
Clarification. For clarification on a quote that was given from the bill as to whether or not it was actually Section 9, sub 4 or 5, because if we can't follow, we need to be able to follow around. I was wondering, we need to follow along, and I need to know if that was a correct statement as far as what section he was reading from. Mm.
Thank you. And I appreciate the request for a clarification, Mr. Speaker. Obviously, the section numbers have been renumbered since the material that I am reading from was prepared. And I have to tell you that I do not know precisely which section I am referring to, and I appreciate the clarification.
I think it would be most appropriate probably to ask for such a clarification during a question period in general. If Point of order from Representative Richardson.
It's my understanding of Masons is that if there is information that's being presented that's not appropriate or that's just a mistake, that it's a time it's appropriate to get a clarification at that time so that the body can follow along.
If we do that, we do need to make sure that the clock stands still while he is responding to that point.
Thank you.
Representative, please go ahead and continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Let me note generally members, I'm sure you had had a great enjoyment reading this bill. This bill is a master of clarity and a reading of any portion of the black letter parts of the bill, I think, will make it clear that this is an enormous simplification of the current bonding law in Oregon. Sections 1 through 40 relate to the state borrowing, including the treasurer's responsibilities that I've been outlining. Sections 41 through 70 describe the local bonding authority and it sets them up in a neat and simple to read package. The balance of the bill, pages 40 through the end, are revisions of particular statutes in reference to this statute and both referring to this bill and making minor changes in a variety of other statutes which the bill makes necessary. And I think rather than referring to section numbers which have been renumbered, I'm going to simply describe some of the other changes that were made. There are some detailed changes. For example, there's a section which deletes the requirement that counties hold a public hearing before they call a bond election. No other local government is required to hold a bond hearing before it submits a bond election to voters, and the section deletes that requirement. This is one of those details where that demonstrate the statute has grown up over time.
Representative Gelster yields.
Thank you, Representative Gelster. And with great increasing complexity, these simplifications treat all local governments in the same way. And I think rather than reading the other changes, I will stop here and answer questions if there are any, except to make note of one specific change that was not requested by the Law Commission, but was requested by the Eugene Springfield Municipal Wastewater Commission, and that is the amendment found in Section 232A, which allows an intergovernmental entity created by units of local government to borrow through the fund established under the Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund. This is an example of a local agency which was simply left out of the original statute, and this adds it back in. The change was made with the concurrence of the commission. And with that, rather than trying to continue reciting the details, I'll stop and answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Barnard, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Let me simply say the commission has done many, many thousands of dollars worth of work, all volunteer, in connection with this bill. The bill will save the state of Oregon, our agencies, local governments, untold dollars in bond attorney fees, and perhaps in the bonding costs themselves, since bond interest rates are adjusted based on the risk. Colleagues, I commend this bill to your attention and urge an aye vote.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Wisnett, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Greg Smith, how do you vote? Greg Smith votes aye. Representative Gilliam? How do you vote? He votes aye. House Bill 3265A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Final reading, memorials and resolutions. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that House Joint Memorial 24 be made a special order of business as the first item on Tuesday, June 5, 2007, on the afternoon calendar. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Bills, reports, and other business line on the table. First reading of Senate bills. Second reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 69, relating to emergency lottery computer database center. Senate Bill 154, relating to landlord-tenant law. Senate Bill 211, relating to school financing and claim numbers. Senate Bill 253, relating to approval of workers' compensation claim disposition agreement. Senate Bill 288, relating to parole hearings and murder cases and declaring an emergency.
Bills read second time or passed to third reading. Third reading of Senate bills. Clerk will read the bill.
Senate Bill 261, relating to post-secondary instructional materials and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 261. Representative Compt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Senate Bill 261 comes to you from the Full Education Committee. Currently, when you have any visual impairment, you cannot always get your textbook or your resources in an effective way to access all the instructional materials. This bill requires publishers of instructional materials for post-secondary students upon request from post-secondary education institutions to provide materials in electronic format for the use of students with print disabilities for education purposes. When I was in my doctoral program just a few years ago, it was almost 10, but I had a colleague that had to go print up all of her materials herself on a photocopying machine before she could ever have time, before she could ever read it. And this bill actually takes care of this issue. And it's a basic assistive technologies at Oregon's public universities include screen readers for students who are blind, screened enlargers for students with low vision, speech recognition for students with mobility issues, and in-class computer-based note-taking for students with hearing impairments. Disability service offices at institutions are responsible for manually scanning and formatting textbooks for the for students who require alternative formats. Students came to our committee and testified that they, in some cases, cannot obtain textbooks in an alternative format in a timely way and suffer in their coursework, and sometimes even to the point of having to withdraw from their courses and retake them once the materials are available. The Senate Education and the General Government Committee gave Senate Bill 626A a due pass, and we ask for your support here on the House floor. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Compt, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Gilliam, how do you vote? Gilliam votes aye. All have voted. Senate Bill 261A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will need the next bill.
Senate Bill 264, relating to reporting abuse of persons with developmental disabilities.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 264B. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, Senate Bill 264B comes to you from your Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee. This bill does a couple of things. The first is that it adds to the mandatory abuse reporting statute the requirement to report suspected abuse of adults with developmental disabilities. It also extends protections to adults with developmental disabilities who may be experiencing physical or sexual abuse or neglect. In current statute, the department's ability to investigate allegations of abuse of an adult with developmental disabilities only exists for individuals who are currently enrolled in services. The unintended consequence of this is that when there is a case of suspected abuse, we've had circumstances where families have pulled that individual from services in order to prevent having this investigation take place. This change in the statute would eliminate that barrier and allow the department or its designee to investigate potentially abusive situations even when that person has been removed from services to avoid an investigation. There was a recent case where this happened. The Oregon Advocacy Center, which is the state's protection and advocacy center providing legal services for people with disabilities, was contacted by state officials and asked to initiate a challenge to that individual's guardianship so that a young woman could be removed from her home for medical examination. It had been alleged that the woman was severely neglected, and there was concern that she was being sexually abused. However, because the guardian removed this individual from services, the legal counsel for the state informed them that they had no authority to conduct this protective service investigation or to provide the necessary protective services. Senate Bill 264B will expand eligibility for protective services to people with developmental disabilities who have been previously determined to be eligible for services. So they do need to have been eligible for services at some time. And it will allow DHS to go to court to ask for a protective order if it is necessary to protect the health of safety of any individual with developmental disabilities, even if their guardians have removed them from services in order to try to avoid these protective actions. Colleagues, this is an important bill which will extend important protections to some of our most vulnerable friends and neighbors. Please join me in voting yes on Senate Bill 264.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Gelser, do you wish to close? She does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Wisnett, how do you vote? Representative Wisnett, vote aye. Senate Bill 264B, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 554, relating to public records.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 554A. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, Senate Bill 554 goes to one of the cornerstones of representative government, and I ask you to join me in supporting it. One thing I think we all count on in government is access to information. Unless there's a good reason to the contrary, citizens should have access to information and records maintained by government. Fortunately, that's usually true. Senate Bill 554 aims to clean up the process surrounding public records requests. I'm happy to support this bill, particularly because I've been on the receiving end of these requests. When I worked in the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C., we got a lot of requests, and I'm here to tell you, despite our best efforts, oftentimes it took considerable time to determine whether we even had the records, let alone gather them. Senate Bill 554 addresses this situation by establishing regular and understandable processes. First off, the bill requires a government agency who receives a public records request to respond, quote, as soon as practicable and without unreasonable delay, end quote. And it gives the agency some options. They can ask for additional information to clarify the request. They can let the requester know that the agency doesn't have the records. They could provide the records directly. They can let the requester know that the agency has some of the records and provide an estimate of the time it will take to prepare the records and of the costs to the requester. They can let the requester know that the agency may have some of the records and provide an estimate of when they'll know the time they need to find the records and the costs. Or they can provide information that state or federal law prohibits acknowledging that the records exist, or providing them would result in a loss of federal benefits or sanction. That statement requires a specific citation to the relevant state or federal law. The bill also requires agencies to make available to the public a written procedure for making public records requests. That would include names to whom requests may be directed and the ways the agency calculates the fees associated with those requests. Colleagues, this is a practical approach and a needed step to help citizens gain access to one of the keys to good government, and that's information. The bill represents the combined efforts of the Attorney General's Office, the Secretary of State's Office, the Association of Oregon Counties, the Oregon School Boards Association, Oregon Newspaper Publishers, and other stakeholders, and it comes to you with the unanimous support of your Judiciary Committee. I urge your aye vote. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier?
Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
Thank Representative Crummell, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thanks, Representative. So any person can make a request to any public body for any record, and as I'm reading this, the public body is obligated to give the person a copy of the record or let them see the record as soon as is practicable and without unreasonable delay. Is that correct?
Representative, I think you're partially correct. Definitely the agency would be obligated to respond. There may be situations where the agency would say that the records are not subject to disclosure, but the requester would receive a response.
Thank you. Further question, Mr. Speaker?
Further question, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
Yes, he does.
Thank you, Representative. You brought up in your previous answer that there may be times where they have to respond, but there may be times when they can't disclose the record. So let's suppose for a moment that a parent has a student in school and they have requested a meeting with the school regarding either a Section 504 or an IEP, an Individualized Education Plan, for that student. And they want the records of the meeting after it has occurred. Is the school district going to be obligated to give the parent the results and the minutes from the meeting as a request, or is there going to be some other means for them to hide behind and say no, primarily as a delay tactic?
Representative, I'm afraid I can't give you a very specific answer. The answer would be determined by whether those specific records would be subject to non-disclosure, and we'd need to look in statute to determine that.
Thank you. To the bill, Mr. Speaker.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I know this sounded like a very complicated question, and it is a complicated question. And the reason why it's complicated is because many times I have heard from constituents where one of my local school districts is hiding behind the Federal Education Reporting Act, otherwise known as FERPA, to not give information to a parent who has requested information after a meeting has occurred with the student and the special education director or some other person in the school district with regards to either an individualized education plan for the student or a 504 plan. And this is extremely important because there are times when parents, especially in those situations, as well as in the talented and gifted situations, where parents don't feel like they're getting a fair shake from their school districts or from their ESDs. And when they get asked for these records, they're getting delay tactics, and they're getting excuses as to why they can't get the records. Usually the excuse given is FERPA. And unless the parent goes and hires an attorney who is very familiar with the education reporting standards and act of the federal government, they may never see the records that they're trying to get. I'm very hopeful that this bill, I'm going to vote yes on it, I'm very hopeful that this bill is going to help parents that are placed in that kind of a situation be able to get the information that they need and they want, especially where their own children are involved in these types of issues. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Reed, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Reed does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. All have voted. Senate Bill 554A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 641, related to hunting and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 641A. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, this is an unusual day in our House, as I'm sure you will agree in a minute. I am bringing you Senate Bill 641, which is a hunting bill. It comes to you from your House Health Care Committee. And lest you begin to wonder how it could be that the representative from Corvallis is bringing you a hunting bill, this has to do with issuing permits to individuals with disabilities who are going hunting. And this basically allows physician assistants to write the notes that certify that an individual has a disability for the purposes of a disabled hunting permit. Current law only allows a licensed physician or a certified nurse practitioner to assign these permits for hunters and anglers with disabilities, and this creates an especially difficult time for those hunters and anglers with disabilities in our rural areas. This bill will remedy that and will help to ensure that all Oregonians, regardless of disability, can enjoy the fine sports of hunting and angling. Please join me in voting yes on Senate Bill 641.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Gelser, do you wish to close? She does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Shields, how do you vote? Representative Shields votes aye. Representative Gilliam, how do you vote? Representative Gilliam votes aye. Representative Dallum, how do you vote? Representative Dallum votes aye. All have voted. Senate Bill number 641A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The House will stand at ease. We are waiting for the carrier of the next bill to arrive. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 716, relating to parking for persons with disabilities.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 641A. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr.
Excuse me, Representative Buckley, that is Senate Bill 716A.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd love to have it all clarified. Colleagues, Senate Bill 716A helps disabled citizens that use a wheelchair. Oregon law requires building owners to provide parking spaces for use by disabled persons with parking placards based on the size of the lot. For example, parking lots with up to 25 spaces provide at least one disabled parking space, while lots between 400 and 500 spaces need to designate at least 9 disabled parking spots. Further, one in every 8 disabled parking spaces, but at least one space, must be van accessible, meaning it should be 9 feet wide with adjacent 8-foot aisles. The reason this is important is to accommodate vans with side lifts that extend for wheelchairs. Over time, the conditions for which disabled placards are granted laws have been granted has grown, and disabled parking spaces are harder to come by. Senate Bill 716A requires at least one currently designated disabled van accessible space to be set aside and signed for wheelchair users only in lots with up to 400 parking spaces. Parking lots with more than 500 total spaces are required to designate one in every 8 disabled spaces for wheelchair users only. Colleagues, this is basically a bill to make sure that folks who have wheelchairs and are traveling with wheelchairs have the ability to get in and out of the vans that transport them. It's a great bill. I encourage your support.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Buckley, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Representative Clem votes aye. Representative Butler, how do you vote? Representative Butler votes no. Representative Flores, how do you vote? Representative Flores votes aye. Senate Bill 716A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 985, relating to post-conviction relief and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 985. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, 985 comes to you from your Judiciary Committee, where it passed unanimously. The bill prohibits petitioners in post-conviction relief proceeding from compelling their victim to testify either by deposition or hearing unless a court allows the petitioner to do so. It requires a court to allow a petitioner to compel a victim to testify if the petitioner can demonstrate a good cause by showing that the victim has information that is material to the post-conviction relief proceeding. It's favorable to the petitioner and is other than what was admitted at trial. It also allows the victim to appear by telephone with the court's permission. And colleagues, let me just tell you why we need this law. Post-conviction relief, they can compel the person can compel the victims in. Oregon's more liberal than most states on that without this, if we don't put this bill into effect today. The Shelley and Philip Lindsay family down in Ashland, it was kind of the impetus for this. In 1998, their 8 youngest children, all diagnosed with developmental, physical, and emotional disabilities, were brutally raped and sodomized by a teenage neighbor. His name was Ryan Smith. The children were between 7 and 12 years of age at the time of the crime. After a long trial, a trial in 1999, Mr. Smith was found guilty of 5 counts of sex abuse in the first degree, 4 counts of sodomy in the first degree, 2 counts of rape in the first degree. Because he was under 15, he wasn't exposed to the Major 11, and he was sentenced to 8 days in juvenile detention, probation, in order to participate in community-based treatment. Fortunately for future victims in Oregon, he refused to comply with those restrictions and ended up in the Oregon Youth Authority until he was 25. But he called for a post-conviction relief hearing and wanted to have these children, who are now older, but come back in and go through their rapes, their sodomization, all over again in his lawyer's office with him. And I'll tell you, if you've never been subject to a hostile deposition, you are fortunate, because they can ask anything. It doesn't even need to be relevant. One of the kids tried to commit suicide rather than go through this procedure again. And the long story short, I'll shorten this up, the post-conviction relief failed for Mr. Smith, even though he brought in those children, called them liars, required the family to submit 15 years of private documents for this deposition. The post-conviction relief was denied January of this year, and so now Mr. Smith will have to finish up his time with the Youth Authority. But families and victims should not be forced to go through these kind of things. Please vote yes.
Further discussion? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
Yes, he does.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Mr. Speaker. On line 14 of the bill, it says that the court, and about midway through, it says the court may allow the victim to appear by telephone or other communication device approved by the court. Was there any discussion about turning that may into a shall, so that the victim could be further protected at their request, that would compel the court to allow them to testify by other means?
I don't believe we discussed that, but they want to give some judicial discretion in there. The may allow would a court could take into consideration all the points and may allow that. They may not also.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Barker, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Nolan, how do you vote? Representative Nolan votes aye. All voted. Senate Bill 985, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 91, relating to construction contractors.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 91A. Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This bill requires a licensed contractor to notify the Construction Contractors Board of changes to the names and or addresses of owners, officers, managers, members, trustees, or responsible managing individuals. If the applicant for a contractor's license is a trust, requires the name of the trustees on the application. Specifically, this bill addresses the fact that LLCs are becoming common use, and this is an update of the language for the Contractors Board. There was no opposition in the Senate, and this was a unanimous vote. Should be a no-brainer.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Girard, do you wish to close? He does not. Excuse me. Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Rise to state a potential conflict.
Representative Bruin, please state your conflict.
I'm employed by a contractor that's regulated by the CCB.
So noted for the record. Representative Boone, for what reason do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I also declare a potential conflict of interest because I am a half-owner in a construction company authorized by the CCB.
Representative Boone's conflict is so noted. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Potential conflict.
Please state your conflict.
I'm a licensed contractor in the state of Oregon.
Representative Schaffler's conflict is noted for the record. Further discussion? Thank you. Those of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Representative Clem votes aye. All voted. Senate Bill 91A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 222, relating to motor carriers and declaring an emergency.
The question now rises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 222A. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, Senate Bill 222A brings Oregon into compliance with federal motor carrier laws. It seems like I get to bring Oregon into compliance on a number of things, so with the federal government. In 2005, federal legislation, Safety Lou, that reauthorized the highway programs preempted state registration and state insurance requirements for interstate motor carriers by creating a base state system known as the Unified Carrier Registration Agreement. Under the agreement, motor carriers will be required to register and pay fees in their base state and to carry liability insurance, but will not be required to provide insurance information to each state in which they operate. Please note, states are not precluded from requiring carriers to obtain additional state credentials, such as the weight mile tax certification. Oregon will receive funds back through the agreement that will cover implementation costs and additional funds for truck safety enforcement. Oregon met a November of 2006 deadline to submit a non-binding statement of intent to participate. Senate Bill 222A is the necessary legal authorization for the Oregon Department of Transportation to enter into the Unified Carrier Registration Agreement, and I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, you may note that I voted
to the bill.
No, to the bill. Thank you. You may note that I voted against this bill. This is another instance where the federal government has put us in a catch-22 position. We have to pass this bill, and yet this makes Oregon's law, which was a better law than what the federal government is proposing. The Oregon law is more stringent and is a better law. We have to pass this, but it is a bad requirement that the federal government is putting on us, and I will continue to be a no. But if it comes to 31 votes, I'll have to change my vote to yes because it will have to pass.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
Yes, I do.
Yes, she does.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Representative. I noticed in going through the materials for this bill that it shows an expenditure of $1 million from the department. I also noticed that it's not anticipated by the governor's recommended budget. Can you tell me where the revenues are going to come from that will pay for that $1 million?
I was just double checking here. good representative from Wilsonville. This is pass-through money. We'll be collecting about $6 million to register trucks and passing it through, and we'll get to keep about $1 million. I have a nice little note from fiscal on a little yellow sticky here that says the net effect is zero, no general fund dollars, no lottery dollars, and does not need ways and means.
Thank you. Further question?
Further question, does the carrier yield?
I do.
Yes, she does.
Thank you, Representative, for the explanation on that. Under Oregon statute, I believe that for a department to be an agency to be able to expend funds, that they have to have an expenditure limitation. Can you tell me where in the bill the expenditure limitation for this $1 million is?
Thank you for the question. good staff has said that we're not seeing it in the budget line, but I know that this bill just allows us to collect the fees, and I assume that any fees we keep... wait a minute. I was just looking here. Any of the fees we keep... let's see, fees for this new system are yet to be established by the Board of Directors, but participating states are assured of retaining and receiving at least $500 in fees annually. Fees collected may be used for motor carrier safety programs enforcement or administration of the plan and agreement. And this not being a budget, this is basically saying that we're going to participate in this program. I assume the spending authority will be in the Transportation Department budget.
Thank you. Further question?
Further question, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
Yes, she does.
Thank you, Representative. Will this, with the explanation that you just gave, will this bill at any point in time have a conflict amendment put in it to allow for the expenditure of the funds?
I'm guessing at this point it has not been pointed out that it needs one, so I don't anticipate it.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Speaker, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to move Senate Bill, Senate 22A, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Krummel has moved that Senate Bill 222A be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I think there's a lot of unanswered questions with regards to this bill, one of them being $1 million in expenditure limitation that doesn't seem to appear anywhere. Now, I've gone out on a limb here, and my caucus leadership doesn't know that I was going to make this motion, so they're caught unaware. My caucus doesn't know that I was going to make this motion. Your caucus doesn't know, when I was speaking to the other side of the aisle, that I was going to make this motion, and neither does the chief clerk. But as you can tell, they've done a great job of getting it up there on the board. The importance of this is that this is part of our budgeting process. This is not anticipated by the governor's budget. There is not an expenditure limitation put in this bill. There is not an expenditure limitation that we know of or are aware of. There are no conflict amendments that we're aware of that are going to be put into this bill, because this is the last stop for this bill because it's a Senate bill. Now, if we're serious about having our budget under control and knowing where our revenues are coming from and knowing where our expenditures are going, then you will agree with me and you will send this bill down to Ways and Means so that it can be vetted there from a standpoint of the budgetary ramifications. I don't have a big problem with the policy that's in the bill. But what I have a problem with is that we have an inconsistency, ladies and gentlemen, in how we are doing things. Because what we're doing is that we're sending bills to Ways and Means that we can't get out. And then we have a bill like this that has $1 million attachment to it for an expenditure with no limitation either in the bill or anywhere else in the budget that we're aware of. We have revenues being shown here of $6 million. And when it was pointed out that or asked where it is in the bill, it was stated to me that it was in the other written documentation, if I understood correctly. Ladies and gentlemen, if we're serious about budgeting, if we're serious about consistency, if we're serious about transparency, then bills like this do not just pass across the floor without going to Ways and Means and without being vetted in the process as far as the expenditure limitation is concerned. I ask for your aye vote on the motion to refer this bill to the Committee on Ways and Means. They can deal with it very quickly down there. It can be taken care of, it can be done, and it can be back on this floor probably before you and I have a chance to blink our eyes twice. So I would ask you to pass the motion. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? On the motion, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, as you'll note from the fiscal impact statement you have in your bill files on this bill, Legislative Fiscal Office has already looked at this bill, coordinated it with the work that is being done on budgets, and really has nothing further to add that would help us make good decisions on this bill. I think we can make the decision today. And sending it to Ways and Means will only slow not only this bill, but other bills that the Ways and Means committees are working on. So I encourage us to reject this motion.
Further discussion to the motion? Representative Beyer.
Thank you. Colleagues, this bill allows us to enter into this agreement to register on a federal level. Right now, we're registering these trucks and taking this money in and spending it in our budget now. This just prohibits us from doing that in the future, and we'll be entering into this agreement where we will be keeping some of the money and putting it back in that we would be losing on our registration.
Further discussion on the motion? Representative Krummel, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm almost speechless. I can't, you know, I realize that it says that there's a zero at the bottom. But we have money coming in. We don't know where it's coming from. We have money going out. They say the fiscal statement says that the money's going to go to $350,000 for computer programming, $120,000 for credit card transaction fees, and $480,000 for motor carrier safety enforcement. But where's the detail? And if we're going to do budgeting based on sticky notes being passed to a representative once they're on the floor, then once again, I guess what I would say is, ladies and gentlemen, just bring the governor's budget out here or bring the co-chair's budget out here and let's vote on it. We can be out of here before the end of the week. I have a real disagreement with the notion that we are going to pass a bill that has revenue and expenditure ramifications, and there is nothing. We are silent on what the limitations are, what the money can be spent for. And I guess what you're saying, by the way, if you pass, if the motion fails and you pass the bill, I guess that what you're saying is that it's okay if we're going to have $6 million in revenues coming in, and that the portion of fees remitted to the UCRA depository of $5 million is okay. Then I guess that's okay. I just have a fundamental problem with how we are doing this, and I would ask for your aye vote on the motion to send it to the Committee on Ways and Means. And, Mr. Speaker, I respectfully request a call of the House.
Representative Crummell requests a call of the House. He is joined by Representative Nelson, Representative Dallum, Representative Girard, Representative Lim, and Representative Gillum. The clerk doorkeepers will bar the doors, the sergeant-at-arms will attend, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Berger-Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Buckley-Burley, Butler, Butler-Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Clem-Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Esquivel-Flores, Galizio, Gerard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilliam-Gilman, Gilman-Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Hunt-Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummell, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Roblin-Rosenbaum, Rosenbaum-Schaffler, Scott, Scott Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Thatcher Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Berger, Buckley, Butler, Esquivel, Gilliam, Gilman, Hunt, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Thatcher, Mr. Speaker, excused, not subject to the call, one, Burley.
All members are present. Those of the opinion Senate Bill 222A should be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. All members have voted. The motion refers Senate Bill 222A to the Committee on Ways and Means. Having failed to receive the majority, is declared failed. Further discussion on the bill? Representative Butler. On the bill?
Yes. Question to the carrier.
Question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield? Yes, the carrier yields.
Representative, in some of the materials, and particularly with regard to the LFO analysis, it talks about safety lieu in various places. I just wanted you to assure the this body that safety lieu had nothing to do with guarding porta potties on ODOT work sites.
Yes, good representative, I can certainly assure you that this has nothing to do with that.
Further question.
Yes. Further question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
Yes, she does.
Would you tell the Legislative Assembly what safety lieu does stand for? It doesn't stand for guarding of porta potties on work sites for ODOT.
Thank you, good representative. I understood you were going to ask that, and we I don't have the acronym, but it is the Federal Highway Reauthorization in 2005, and I cannot tell you exactly what each of these letters stands for. But Lou was the first name of the sponsor's wife.
Oh. to the bill.
That I know.
to the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you.
Yes.
Colleagues, we've had a pretty decent discussion about this. You'll note that I voted no in committee on this particular bill, and I still don't believe that Lou was the first name of the wife of the carrier of this bill, actually. But I am concerned about the high cost of transportation and motor carrier in the state of Oregon. There's some indication that Oregon information indicates that operating a truck in Oregon, Oregon is number one in terms of total cost of operating of licensing a truck and getting a truck authorized and licensed and on the road, and it's not number one by a slim margin. This is over $11,000 cost, where New York State is the 49th state, or second state, I guess, as you're going up and down that scale. But Oregon is over $11,000, while the next state to us, being New York State, being a very expensive state to operate in, is a little over $8,000. So Oregon is a very, very expensive state. We continue to put these kinds of costs and deferred items over to the trucking industry. I think if you were to examine the cost per mile driven, and I have a question to the department or to the Legislative Fiscal Office to know how much more it costs to operate in Oregon than it does in Washington or California, Idaho, Montana, Utah, and surrounding states. There's some indication that Oregon is the top state in the nation to operate in by a huge, huge margin. And it was jokingly said last week, well, you don't have to worry about that because Oregon keeps Washington and California landlocked. And I would state to you that while they can state that, we need to recognize that Oregon's ports could become widowed and orphaned ports if we're not careful, because those ships along the Pacific Rim who decide that they want to use the Pacific Rim can choose Canada and Mexico and Washington and California more easily than they could choose Oregon at that point. And I think that it's high time that we got back to the ways and means process relative to all of the costs dealing with transportation in Oregon, so that we could take a look at this. Now, for those of you who have been here for a few years, remember that ODOT dodged the bullet in 2001, 2002, 2003, and they have continued both before and after that time to dodge the bullet with regard to their fees, their costs, and their operations. They didn't take any cuts during the time when the rest of the state was taking cuts. And so I think that it is appropriate for the questions to have been asked today, and it's appropriate for us to really question whether or not we want to continue to expand the costs of driving commercial vehicles in Oregon at the loss of potentially our economic viability of our ports.
Further discussion? Representative Olson.
Question of the carrier, Mr. Speaker.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
Yes, she does.
Representative, in the Senate bill, it talks about the department may adopt rules several different times, so permissive language. But what I'd like to refer to is the staff measure summary, the last paragraph. And I'll just read the second, starting the second sentence. Motor carriers will be required to register and pay fees to their base state and to carry liability insurance, but will not be required to provide insurance information to each state in which they operate or carry or display state certifications. So I guess I need some clarification on that. If I'm a trooper out on the road and I investigate a motor vehicle accident involving an 18-wheeler, are they going to have some proof of insurance on board their vehicle for me to know that?
Yes, good representative. Yes, they will. They just won't have to get individual state proof, but they will have to carry proof of insurance. It just won't be the state that was giving it.
Okay, thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I'm a no. This has not been vetted in the Ways and Means process, as I discussed earlier during the earlier motion. And even if I agreed with the policy, because of the fact that this is not part of our budgeting process, and this is a very poor way for us to be acting in this body, is to have bills that have a revenue and an expenditure effect, and we don't know what the ramifications of that are. We don't know. It says here, and it shows at the bottom that it's zero, but is it really? This needs to have gone through, it probably needs to have gone through the revenue committee too. Maybe I should have moved it to revenue, since there's $6 million in revenue here. Can't do that now because I've already started speaking on the bill. But my point is that we are ignoring things as we're looking at these policies on some things, but on other issues that have a very small impact, we're sending to Ways and Means. What's interesting is that we had a bill earlier this morning that I was very tempted to move to Ways and Means with a $119,000 fiscal on it. I think it would be very helpful if leadership would give us an indication as to what. Of course, it would have been helpful, I guess, to have this on January 8th as opposed to June 4th. But what is required to be sent to Ways and Means and what isn't? And I think we have been very inconsistent about that, ladies and gentlemen. So with all of that said, I'm a no on this bill because we have an impact on the budget. It's only $1 million. Well, you know, we have $1 million here. And like the senator from Illinois used to say, well, you know, $1 million here and $1 million there, and pretty soon we're talking about real money. And this is potentially Oregonians' money, dollars that have been taken out of their pockets to pay gas taxes or to pay other kinds of fees, car registration fees, pay income taxes, cigarette taxes, alcohol taxes. So I think that with this kind of an impact, it is incumbent upon us to act responsibly and not approve this bill and send it down to Ways and Means and maybe even to Revenue and have them take a look at it to make sure that all of the things that we have in here are the way they say. I appreciate the fact that we rely on our staff, on our professional staff a lot, and I appreciate the job that our professional staff in legislative fiscal does. But we have to also remember that it is not our job to just rubber stamp everything that they say. We have our own brains, at least most of us do, and we need to use them to question some of these things. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Byer, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, I think I probably should. First off, I do want to assure everybody after some checking that this is already currently in the base budget of the Motor Carrier Division. So it has already been considered and is in there. There is no cost to the state on this bill. The permissive language is because the system is not up and operating yet, and so we need to be able to go whenever it is up and operating. And again, this is a bill that I wasn't very thrilled with, and a number of my committee members weren't very thrilled with, but we can't collect any of this information anymore. And this is a federal preemption that we're just going to have to live with. And one other thing, Safety Lou stands for Safe, Accountable, Flexible, Efficient Transportation Equity Act, Legacy for Users. And I urge you to support this bill.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Witt, how do you vote? Representative Witt votes no. Representative Scott, how do you vote? Representative Scott votes aye. Senate Bill number 222, excuse me, Representative Tomei, for what purpose do you rise?
I'd like to change my vote from yes to no.
Representative Tomei changes her vote from yes to no. Representative Scott, for what purpose do you rise?
I also would like to change from yes to no.
Representative Scott changes his vote from yes to no. Representative Smith, what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to change my aye to nay.
Representative Smith changes his vote from an aye to a nay. Senate Bill 222A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Barker, for what reason do you rise?
Mr. Speaker, I request we return to courtesies.
Representative Barker requests unanimous consent to return to the order of courtesies. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, there's a group of fifth graders from Kinnaman Elementary School in my district. The leader of the group is Patrick Webb, and I hope you guys all have a great day here at the Capitol. Thank you.
Welcome to the Capitol. Are there further courtesies? Seeing none, the clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 440, relating to documents pertaining to manufacturer structure ownership.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 440B. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, it's most that I carry this bill, but it's very meaningful because this bill was in the 2001, the 2003, the 2005, and now the 2007 session, all for my terms. But what's ironic is that I'm carrying a bill on behalf of tax assessors. But here goes. In 2001, we appointed a tax work groups, a task force, to look at many different ways to accommodate the task of developing and moving an entire process and system from one agency to another, from the DMV to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It was a big challenge, but it was felt that the benefits would outweigh the obstacles. What the task force was asked to do was to develop a system that would bring manufactured structures on the same level as real property or stick-built houses. Appropriate that I carry the bill because that's the reason I came to Oregon. My husband being the one of the general managers of Skyline Mobile Homes. It was determined that the best path to follow for implementation of this supplemental information would be by statute rather than administrative rule. So Senate Bill 440 has been crafted to accomplish this task. And just briefly, because I know I'll be asked, what was developed is now known as the Lois system. Lovely name for a woman. Named after Lois Colson, an employee of the Department of Revenue and a member of the original work group, unfortunately, who was unable to see the project to completion as she died of cancer prior to the passage of Senate Bill 468 that was passed by the 2003 legislature, which transferred the titling and licensing of manufactured structures from the DMV, as I said, to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Just so you can explain this, why we've had this so many times, because manufactured homes are personal property, one of the major missing elements is that the old DMV system was the lack of sales and physical information connected with a home. The type of information is readily available for real property, but not for manufactured homes. All the stakeholders of the work group agreed that this information was essential in that it developed a reporting system that could be used by lenders to determine comparable sales for lending purposes or for these county assessors for better administration of the property tax system. Senate Bill 468, however, like many of the bills we've already passed this session that will come back, because we left out something. Senate Bill 468 did not specifically define the supplemental information. Senate Bill 440B is needed to correct the problem and require the purchase price, built-ins, and other upgraded features as recorded supplemental information about the home, just as in real property when a building permit is issued. So basically, you know, modular and mobile homes are in the same category of any other personal real property. With such a large conversion, things are sometimes missed. The second section of this bill deals with one such problem. Prior to the Lois system, when a manufactured home was sold and ownership transferred, there was no requirement that all the property taxes be paid. I mean, there was a requirement that all property taxes be paid. This bill now protects the buyer and seller, assuring there are no tax liens against the property. This requirement was inadvertently left out of the original bill. Senate Bill 440 will correct this problem and require that all levied property taxes be paid at the time of ownership transfer. So it's a good bill, and I hope we don't get it back in the next session. So let's be sure we vote yes and get it on its way. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Nelson, do you wish to close?
No, sir.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Crummell, how do you vote? Representative Crummell, how do you vote? Representative Crummell votes aye. All have voted. Senate Bill 440B, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 777, relating to rehabilitation property tax abatements. Rehabilitated property tax abatements.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 777A. Representative Roberson-Baum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I bring you Senate Bill 777 that comes to you from the House Committee on Revenue. Senate Bill 777 extends the sunset date for an existing program that allows a 10-year partial exemption from property taxes for the rehabilitation of housing or the conversion of buildings to housing. Currently, this program is scheduled to sunset at the end of this year, and the bill would extend the sunset date until January 1st of 2017. Since 1975, local jurisdictions have been authorized to provide a limited tax abatement for the purpose of rehabilitating residential property that has code violations and is located in what are considered distressed areas. This program, the committee found, has been successful in encouraging home ownership in some of those distressed areas and also in encouraging the inclusion of rental property and the affordability of rental property by allowing the owners of that property to fix up property that's not up to code and then make it available in the housing stock. The goal of the program is to encourage neighborhood revitalization through the rehabilitation and improvement of owner-occupied properties, and we have found it to be a successful program. One additional change the bill makes is that now the improvements in these properties would have to be made within 2 years of their initial application. The committee voted unanimously to endorse this proposal, and I would urge you to do so as well and vote aye.
Further discussion. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Questions of the carrier, please.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes, I do.
Yes, she does.
Thank you, good representative. For this body, could you confirm the lost revenue that LO Legislative Revenue Office estimates for next budget?
Thank you, Representative. I believe that all members have received a revenue impact statement on the bill. And there is, it looks like, no revenue impact in 07-08, no revenue impact whatsoever to the state, but there is a revenue impact to local governments in 08-09 and beyond. Members can look at it for themselves. It looks like 08-09 would be $29,205 in 08-09 to local governments and $20,295 to school district. Did you wish me to read all of the figures on that statement or
clarification?
I'll have another question for the carrier.
Another question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Yes, she does.
Good representative. I was speaking about, I read the impact statement. I think it says, would you confirm that's $900,000 in the next budget?
Thank you, Representative, for that question. I think I can clarify the $900,000 figure that you referred to was the estimated revenue impact that was in the annual tax expenditure report that is published every year. However, because this bill will phase this program out over time, the actual revenue impact that LRO has come up with is significantly less than that, and so you see the figures in front of you on the revenue impact statement of what is now proposed to be the actual revenue impact. The $900,000 was a projected impact previous to this bill.
Another question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
I do.
Yes, she does.
Thank you, good representative. So I'm still looking at the $900,000 as a expenditure for this exemption. Then how much of that would come out of the school fund?
Approximately 42% of the amount would come out of the school fund.
Thank you. Another question, the carrier.
Another question, the carrier. Does the carrier yield? Does the carrier yield?
Yes, I do.
Yes, she does.
Thank you, good representative. My concern, and I have talked to the good representative, and I talked to Legislative Revenue Office last week on this bill, colleagues. My question is, how much have we lost with this exemption for the last 9 years?
Representative, I think if your question is over the past 9 years, how much has this program cost? We believe that approximately $700,000 of that amount, roughly 42%, would be the amount that has come out of potential money that would have otherwise gone to schools. So I don't have a calculator to figure out what that was, but I would say less than half of that amount.
Okay.
And that's over the full 9 years, if that's what you're asking about.
To the bill, Mr. Chairman.
To the bill.
Colleagues, this is a tax exemption. I'm for restoring our areas of our state that need to be restored. My wife grew up in Northeast Portland. I love to see those beautiful homes around there. I still look at this as and I understand talking to the good carrier of this bill that you did discuss the Pearl District guys, but this could still support another Pearl District type of operation. You're taking money out of the schools with this property exemption. You've already done it for 10 years and now you're being asked to do it for another 10 years. Do you really, really want to do this? I understand economic development and how that brings more money in, but we're taking out a lot of money out of the school formula, the school fund, with a tax exemption that we're proposing another 10 years. I'm sorry. I don't think I got the good answers and I talked to the representative and I talked to LFO last week. I think the amount of money that we've lost with these exemptions would probably approach $80 million, and it would probably approach $40 million out of the school fund for the last 9 years. That's a lot of teachers. That's a lot of textbooks. Colleagues, we're looking at about three different bills coming before us about property tax exemption in the near future. From the Oregonian, 31 May, they looked at a tax exemption for historical homes. People were upset because they were talking about homes in Dunthorpe and other exclusive areas of this state. Even the governor's, the first lady, the governor's wife, wasn't happy with some of these tax exemptions, for property tax exemptions. She was able to get the Revenue Committee to agree to some changes where the another Senate bill that's providing this, at Senate Bill 416, was coming forth. Then we find out that we're also exempting property tax on all the homes along the Matolius River. Colleagues, I think we need to defeat this bill. We're talking about money out of the school formula. We're talking about money out of the state, or that would be going to counties to do this. We need to have a task force, as the First Lady proposed, to look at this and be sure we're doing the right thing, that we're not rewarding rich people. There's nothing in here that requires these to be low-cost housing. In this bill, you're going to have rich people buying these houses and not paying property tax. Colleagues, I don't think we want to do this. I think we need a task force. We need to look at which properties we're going to exempt for historical facilities, for pristine cabins on the Matolius River, and for distressed areas in the state of Oregon. We're passing this for 10 years, members, 10 more years of exemption for property tax. The people in the Pearl District are this, poor things. No, they don't have enough money to pay property tax. We're going to put it on the burden of the middle and low class in this state. Ladies and gentlemen, I think this bill, I talked to the good carrier. I know that they talked about some of these issues in committee. I'm telling you that I'm going to vote against extending this for 10 more years. I would support. I understand the economic development of doing this, but we need to look at this property tax exemption. I'll be voting no, and I ask you to vote no.
Further discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I want to point out a couple of things about this bill that are, I think, very important when considering whether or not to vote for it, and also I think part of the reason why your Committee on Revenue passed the bill out in the way it did. My recollection is that it was a unanimous vote with one member excused. Yes, that's right. This bill contains, if you look at Section 1, you'll note that there's a definition of distressed area. There's a definition of a governing body, which I don't mean to go over these quickly, but I do want to cover a couple of basic points. In the first place, no one gets these tax breaks unless they have been vetted through the local governing body, the city or the county legislative body having jurisdiction. So if any property taxes get given away, it's done by the local jurisdictions, not by the legislature. Deterioration is defined in the bill. I'm not going to read it. You can see it on page 1. And then on page 2, when we get down to actually talking about what the bill does, you'll note on line 9 that if the property is owner-occupied, it has to be located in the distressed area as defined on the first page. So we're not talking about something like the Pearl, owner-occupied condominiums of high value, those kind of things. We're talking about properties located in distressed areas as defined by the local government. The other sections have already been referred to, and I'm not going to repeat them, except simply to note that in general, and for general purposes, I certainly agree with the representative from rural Deschutes County that we have to be extremely cautious about granting these kinds of credits or deductions. I would note that the expected fiscal on this one is very small, less than $50,000 a year. And it is a reasonable one, which is used mostly in the city of Portland for the purpose of maintaining housing stock and dealing with low-cost housing, because that city is under great pressure when it comes to converting low-cost housing to yuppification, if I can use that term. So this bill, on balance, is an important bill. The costs are very low. Local governments will make the decisions about which projects are allowed. There are sideboards around this that are reasonable. It is designed specifically to prevent owner-occupied properties in I think the Dunthorpe was mentioned, in the Dunthorpe neighborhood or other non-distressed neighborhoods from benefiting from this kind of credit. I'm the first one in the House who will support the reduction of the number of credits and deductions that we give on property taxes and on other kinds of tax breaks when that's appropriate. In this case, I voted for the bill in committee. I support it. I believe it to be a good bill, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Further discussion. Representative Butler.
Thank you. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Representative, yes, she does.
In southeastern Oregon, I have some, in some of the cities there, some champion old buildings, an old hotel building in Vail, other really nice old buildings that really could be modified and rehabbed into housing. Would this bill then provide local government the opportunity to say, hey, we'll work with you on the taxes while you rehab this into some affordable housing for one of these old buildings?
Well, thank you, Representative, for that question. I think to clarify a couple of things. One is this is not about historic preservation. The properties that would be able to take advantage of this tax abatement have to be in areas that are distressed as defined as properties that have major health and safety code violations in them and are in deteriorating neighborhoods. So if there were such a property in a neighborhood that had been determined to be distressed, and if the improvements to it would be worth more than 50% of the assessed value of the property, which would be a building that really required a great deal of rehabilitation, then it would be up to the local government to decide whether it was a worthwhile exemption to grant. And in that case, if they found that it was, this could very well cause a property that otherwise might be falling down and be a public health hazard to be turned into affordable housing or otherwise made usable.
So just a follow-up question, if I may, Mr.
Follow-up?
Speaker.
Does the carrier yield?
Yes, I do.
Yes, she does.
So this is really another arrow in the quiver, another tool in the toolbox for local governments, for those of us who have some local government background and are anxious that they have the ability to select those areas, not necessarily historic properties, but properties, commercial properties, that are basically going back to nature if there was a possibility to rehab those and they met the other qualifications, then the cities or local governments could then select those properties for this special abatement district.
Yes, Representative, I think it could very well benefit those communities by allowing properties that otherwise would just continue to deteriorate to be made habitable and usable by the community.
To the bill.
To the bill.
This is a local option issue, and it is not a mandate that local governments must do that. And Mr. Chair, I'm just anxious that local governments have all the tools available to them to be able to do these kinds of things. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing no one else in the queue, Representative Wismut is recognized for a second time.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I mentioned several bills. 416 is the historical bill. Here we're talking about 777 for distressed areas. The Pearl District provided very little low-cost housing. It provided tax exemption for those people for 10 years, and we're going to extend it another 10 years. That money, even though it's a local option of where you build it, comes out of the statewide school fund. The tax exemptions that the people in the Pearl District are getting hurt my schools in Deschutes County, and it hurts your schools in your county because that money comes out of the school state fund. Okay? I'm all for this, like I said, but what we need to do is clean it up. We don't need to reward people who are living in $700,000 and $800,000 units and exempting their property tax. If you're building low-cost housing or low-cost units, I'm fine with that. You're exempting very, very expensive units, and a lot of money's coming out of the state school fund. Please vote no. Let's rework these property tax exemptions and be sure we're exempting and helping those people who need help, not people who are living in the Pearl District. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Greenlink.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to comment on the Pearl District because that's in my district. And beforehand, the Pearl District was a bunch of warehouses which the city of Portland were getting very little property tax. The property tax abatements that the city of Portland was able to give created the development in the Pearl District. And at the end of the time period, we'll have millions or hundreds of millions of dollars in property available for taxes, and it's created quite an extraordinary area. I'll invite you to come and walk around the Pearl with me for any of you that want, but you have to imagine what it was like before the redevelopment process. The Pearl District made extraordinary economic sense. It provided construction jobs that made sense, and it's created a lovely neighborhood, a lovely urban environment now that will pour millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions into the tax coffers as soon as that abatement period is over. That is the kind of project we want, one that will take areas that aren't providing taxes and allow them to be developed into housing projects that will be on the rolls for years and years and years to come. I do urge you to vote yes on this bill.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Rosenbaum, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think there is some misunderstanding about what this bill applies to, and with apologies to both the good representative from rural Deschutes County and the good representative from District 33, there's no way that any property in the Pearl District would ever qualify for this program. So I just want to make it clear what this is. It's not the Historic Preservation Program, and the Pearl District programs happen through urban renewal, not through this distressed property program. Any property to qualify for a tax break under this program has to be in a distressed area, which is defined in existing law as a primarily residential area of a county or city that is designated as a distressed area by the county or city because the area is detrimental to the safety, health, and welfare of the community. So what we are talking about here, colleagues, are really rundown properties in very often disadvantaged neighborhoods, and we are providing a small incentive for the owners of those properties to fix them up. The improvements have to be worth more than 50% of the value of the property. So we're talking about major rehabilitation to these properties. It is a very small program with very minimal cost, and it is within the jurisdiction of local governments whether to grant these tax abatements or not. So it is a successful program. The full revenue committee felt it should be extended. That's all the bill does, and I would urge you to vote aye.
Those are who have the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Nelson, how do you vote? Representative Nelson is off the floor. Representative Flores, how do you vote? Representative Flores votes no. Representative Riley, how do you vote? Representative Riley votes aye. Representative Roblin, how do you vote? Representative Roblin votes aye. All voted. Senate Bill 777. Excuse me. Representative Merkley, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I rise to declare a potential conflict of interest.
Please state your conflict.
A good representative from Salem was just showing me a map of Portland, and I may have a rental property inside the boundaries of the district.
That conflict is noted.
Thank you very much.
Senate Bill 77A. 777A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 804 relating to wildlife laws and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 804A. Representative McPherson.
Our Oregon revised statutes must use the written word to express the public policy choices we make in this building. Senate Bill 804 addresses the meaning of one of those words. That word is wild, as used in the statutes on the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. For many years, the ODF&W has interpreted its authority and responsibility as extending to wild birds and wild mammals, whether or not those creatures are currently living in the wild. This position was overturned last fall by the Oregon Supreme Court. The court held that wild birds and wild mammals are limited to animals living untamed and undomesticated in a state of nature. This ruling has the potential for invalidating important efforts of the ODF&W. Let me give you an example of the kind of problem that the ODF&W needs to be addressing. Half a century ago, promoters claimed that the nutria, an animal that was native to waterways in South America, could profitably be raised in Oregon for its fur. Many breeding pairs of nutria were imported into our state, and they developed something of a speculative marketplace in nutria, in which promoters were trying to convince their friends and relatives to invest. Eventually, the bubble burst. After many owners who had acquired these imported animals determined that there was no market for them to actually sell their nutria, instead of destroying them, many of them got released into the wild. What followed was an ecological disaster. Nutria multiplied in Oregon waterways. They burrowed into riverbanks. They destroyed dikes. And I can speak to that from personal experience, because on our family dairy farm, where I was when I was a teenager, we found that the nutria were quite a scourge and made it hard to keep water in our pond. This is the kind of danger that we want the ODF&W to protect us from. But the nutria were not living in the wild when they were brought here. It was only after they escaped into the wild that the problem was identified, and by that time it was too late. Senate Bill 804 solves this problem by adding the phrase "as defined by commission rule" after wild birds and wild mammals in the statute on ODF&W's authority. Rather than try to spell out the definition of wild in statute, this language delegates to the ODF&W the authority to do so by rule. This has the effect of returning the agency to the position it was in before the Supreme Court case, holding authority to determine what is a wild bird or wild mammal for purposes of its programs. The ODF&W has done good work in controlling wild animal populations. We should not curtail their ability to do that important work. Please support Senate Bill 804 to provide the authority and responsibility to regulate wildlife, whether or not currently living in the wild.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative McPherson, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Cameron, how do you vote? Representative Cameron votes no. Representative Garrard, how do you vote? Representative Garrard is off the floor. Representative Flores votes aye. Senate Bill 804A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 5501, relating to financial administration of the Oregon Board of Accountancy and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 5501A. Representative Chris Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I bring you Senate Bill 5501A, the budget bill for the Oregon Board of Accountancy. The Oregon Board of Accountancy regulates the practice and performance of all services provided by licensed accountants. The agency is funded by other funds revenue generated from application and license fees. The subcommittee approved a budget of $1,992,874 other funds, a 25.1% increase from the essential budget level, and 7.0 full-time equivalent positions. The approved budget is a 21.3% increase from the governor's recommended budget. The committee added a package to implement online licensing and a package to establish a list of consultants to provide expertise for the more complex investigations. The subcommittee also recommended the board report to the Joint Legislative Audits Committee during the interim with a progress report on the with progress reports on these issues. I will also note that the budget increases were taken from the Board of Accountancy's ending balance, and there are no fee increases in this budget. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of Senate Bill 5501A.
Further discussion? Representative Butler.
To the bill.
To the bill.
I just wanted to express gratitude to the committees on Ways and Means, joint committees, who have considered the budget bill for the Board of Accountancy and for their wise use of the special masters to get them through some very difficult situations dealing with backlog on very, very difficult cases that are occasioned by the changes in the law, both nationally and throughout the world, relative to accountancy in these difficult and troubled times. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I wish to declare a potential conflict of interest.
Please state your conflict.
I have a license provided from this board.
Your conflict is noted. Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Edwards, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Butler, for what purpose do you rise? Thank you. Representative Butler, how do you vote? Representative Butler votes aye. Representative Boquist, how do you vote? Representative Boquist is off the, excuse me, business of the House. Representative Olson, how do you vote? Representative Olson votes aye. Representative Wisnett. Representative Wisnett votes aye. Senate Bill 5501A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 5521, related to financial administration of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, appropriating money and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 5521A. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, Senate Bill 5521 is the budget bill for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Bureau ensures compliance with state laws relating to apprenticeship, wages and hours worked, terms and conditions of employment, and the rights of workers and citizens to equal and non-discriminatory treatment. The Bureau is primarily funded with the General Fund. The Bureau receives other funds from the assessments on public work contracts, technical assistance fees, and contracts with other government entities. Federal funds are received for civil rights enforcement activities. The Bureau also manages the Wage Security Fund that is used to pay final wages for employees whose employers cease operations and default on final paychecks. The wage security fund comes from a diversion of 0.3% of the unemployment insurance taxes in the last quarter of each odd-numbered year. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means approved a total budget of $22,879,743, including $12.6 million general fund, $6.4 million other funds, $1.5 million federal funds, $2.3 million in the non-limited wage security fund, and 111 full-time equivalents. This includes four policy packages that partially restore civil rights and wage claim enforcement, make a limited duration prevailing wage position permanent, and implement a program to integrate apprenticeship programs with high school workforce development initiatives. There is a reduction of $20,000 general fund to partially offset the cost of the policy packages. The committee approved three budget notes. The Bureau is directed to monitor and report on its wage claim activities and to report on the implementation of the apprenticeship integration program. The Bureau is also directed to work with the Legislative Fiscal Office to revise its key performance measures and report to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee on these measures. The committee recommends approval of Senate Bill 5521. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Question of the carrier?
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Yes, he does.
I was trying to figure this out by looking at the documents, but what amount of the BOLI budget goes to enforcement of illegal immigration, you know, towards employers? In other words, does BOLI use any of this money to seek out those who are not legally able to work in Oregon?
Just one moment. Thank you for that question, good representative. BOLI is not authorized to deal with legal employment or not. They are focused on enforcing current employment law.
Another question of the carrier, please.
Further question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Yes, he does.
Did BOLI request any money for right-to-work enforcement?
Thank you for that question. I think I know the answer to that. No.
Okay. Another question, please.
Further question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Of course.
Yes, he does.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I just kind of came up fast. But if it's illegal for some of these people to be working for employers in Oregon in the first place, why is a state agency using tax resources to send inspectors, investigators out to make sure that the people in the field are getting the wages owed to them? I guess I'm a little confused there.
Can I get a clarification of that question, Mr. Speaker?
Clarification?
Thank you. I'm understanding that BOLI would be able to use or send field investigators out to jobs to make sure that people who may or may not have been authorized to work here in the United States get their wages owed to them. Is that not the case with this bill?
Mr. Speaker, yes, BOLI's statutory authority and duty is to investigate and make sure that workers are paid their wages they are due.
Okay. Another question, please.
Further question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Yes, he does.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience. Is there some federal wage or our law that says illegals are entitled to these wages for jobs they're not supposed to have here, and that the states must enforce this federal law and therefore help the illegals get the wages owed to them that you're aware of?
Mr. Speaker, I believe that enforcement of those type of issues that you're talking about for undocumented workers is the purview of the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
To the bill.
To the bill.
It's my understanding, thank you, back in the 1987 session, by amendment, there was a bill that established Section 181, ORS 181, excuse me, because Boley was exempted. 181.850 disallows any questioning of somebody's legal presence, but Boley was specifically exempted from that because they were doing joint task force raids and enforcement with the federal government. And I guess we're not doing that anymore. I question why we would want to continue funding an organization that is exempt from this law, and they should be enforcing the law and making sure that people, that specifically the Department of Employment would refer out to an employer, is eligible to work here in Oregon. But yeah, I'm going to be a no, and I just think that we need to look at this in the future. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I would be happy to yield to two questions.
Yes, he does.
Well, then we'll just roll them all into one. On page 3 of 4, thank you, Representative, and thank you, Mr. Speaker. On page 3 of 4 of the describing the subcommittee action, it states that there, in a budget note, that Boley should place particular emphasis on monitoring wage claim investigations involving transient or migrant labor in all categories of employment, to ensure that no particular category of transient and migrant labor wage claim investigations receives excessive emphasis. I'm really having a hard time figuring out what that means, but my real question is, how important is this budget note?
Mr. Speaker, I think this budget is very important.
Excuse me, I said budget note. How important is the budget note?
Clarification?
Mr. Speaker, good representative from Wilsonville, it is the direction given from the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. Further question?
Further question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Yes, he does.
Thank you. If this is direction that we as a body want this agency to follow, is there a particular reason why this was not actually put into the legislation so that the agency understands that this is a direction we want them to go and that they are not to ignore it?
To the good representative from Wilsonville, I think what's important to note is that this budget note is related to that policy option package 140, and I do believe it is appropriate, in my view, that the Ways and Means Committee set direction if it feels it is so needed when it passes a policy option package.
Thank you. Further question, Mr. Speaker?
Further question of the carrier. Does carrier yield?
I'm afraid not. We're getting late in the day, and we'd like to get through these bills.
The carrier does not yield.
It's okay. I can be a no.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Shields, do you wish to close?
I do. Thank you to the good representative from Kaiser. I just wanted to say that I've been informed that the bill that you're discussing, that Boley was exempted from, it relates to farm labor contracts. And I think overall this budget is a very good one, particularly the policy option package that I am most proud of is the one that will link high schools to the joint apprenticeship training committees and their training centers. And I think it'll be very important for helping to fill the workforce needs in the construction trades around the state. And I urge your vote. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Barker. Representative Barker votes aye. Senate Bill 5521A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 5525, related to financial administration of the long-term care ombudsman, appropriating money and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 5525A. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Senate Bill 5525 is the budget bill for the long-term care ombudsman. The agency recruits and trains over 200 volunteers to identify, investigate, and resolve non-abuse complaints made by or on behalf of long-term care residents of long-term care facilities such as nursing homes, residential care facilities, assisted living, and adult foster care. The agency also advocates for system changes that promote and protect the rights and interests of long-term care residents. The agency is funded with general fund and federal funds. The majority of the general fund, 83%, is used to match federal funds through the Department of Human Services funding received from DHS. Funding received from DHS is budgeted as other funds. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means approved a total budget of $2.5 million and 9.25 full-time equivalent positions. The approved budget adds a part-time position to handle federal reporting workload and a full-time deputy state long-term care ombudsman position to increase the number of volunteers. The agency has not had additional resources to increase staff since 1990. There are currently four staff ombudsmen for training, supervising, and monitoring investigations for the whole state. They're able to respond to 77% of the non-abuse complaints within one day and, on average, resolve those cases in 11 days. By increasing their capacity with this new position, augmenting staff by 25%, they should be able to increase the number of volunteers, decrease the average time to close a complaint case, and increase the percentage of facilities visited quarterly. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of Senate Bill 5525 as amended.
Further discussion? Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Member, our colleagues, we heard this bill in the Human Services Subcommittee, and we had a very robust discussion in the committee about the bill, and I was a no vote on the budget, and I'd like to tell you why. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office has some coordinators, and the job of these coordinators is to train volunteers. And there are hundreds and hundreds of seniors that volunteer in the state of Oregon. They go out into long-term caregiver homes or facilities and investigate claims of abuse in those facilities. So for the state of Oregon gets an incredible return on investment for the dollars that they put into these coordinators. These coordinators train and oversee hundreds of volunteers. There's a huge need for these people to go out there and investigate these claims. The budget that was voted out of the subcommittee, the co-chair's budget, added one more of these positions. The budget that came out of the governor's office added two more of these positions. Colleagues, adding another position requires an investment of just over $50,000 for the state. The return on the investment is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars in terms of the volunteer hours and the good work that these folks are going to be doing to make sure that Alzheimer's patients and other folks that are in long-term care facilities are getting the care that they need, are receiving the quality of service that they need. This is a tremendous way to keep seniors active in communities, to keep the long-term care system providing a high quality of services, a tremendous return on investment for the state of Oregon. I'm going to continue to vote no on this budget because I think that $52,000 of general fund to add another position is a fabulous way to spend taxpayers' dollars. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to declare a potential conflict.
Representative Girard requests a declare a conflict. Please state your conflict.
I have numerous interests in LLCs and assisted care facilities.
Your conflict is noted for the record. Further discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I just simply want to indicate that I am against this bill, and because of what has already been said and comments from yourself, I'm just disappointed that once again we are essentially placing our senior citizens and our disabled at the back of the bus, and I will be a no. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
Yes, she does.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Mr. Speaker. I notice that on the key performance measures, on numbers 4, 5, 6, and 7, it refers to the percentage of nursing facilities or assisted living facilities or adult foster care homes that are visited once a quarter. Was there discussion in the subcommittee or the full committee with regards to what the outcomes of those visits are from a standpoint of, I'm grateful that they are going to go to 85% of the nursing facilities once a quarter, but what's that going to give us? What's that going to show?
By visiting those facilities, it's a way of being proactive so that even if a complaint has not been, for example, phoned in or mailed in writing, it shows through the ombudsman program that we are visiting, we are being proactive to make sure that people's welfare is being taken care of. So that is the purpose of it. And we certainly hope that that would increase with this 25% increase in staffing that's been proposed.
Thank you. To the bill.
To the bill.
Just a comment briefly, colleagues, on the key performance measures. I'm glad to see that we're going to visit 85% of the the nursing facilities and 50% of the assisted living facilities. But I'm not sure that we got a very good answer in terms of what the outcome of that is going to be. I mean, in a nursing facility, the staff will say, "Oh, hey, look, there's the ombudsman," once each quarter. but so what? And any time we look at key performance measures, one of the things that we want to look at is sort of the so what factor. And so what is just that, so what. And the number of requests for assistance from consumers in number 7, assistance from consumers of public facility staff and agencies, we want it to grow from a target of 5,000 in 08 to a target of 5,200 in 09. But again, so what? I think the real issue here is what's the outcome of that, so that when the request for assistance comes in, how did the ombudsman respond? Because see, the thing is, they could get those many requests, but then the ombudsman could say, oh, nothing I can do about it, so you're on your own. My office has had that happen several times in the last number of years, where we've called an ombudsman and asked for, not necessarily the long-term care ombudsman, but we've called an ombudsman and asked for assistance, and we've got, oh, well, you're on your own because we don't know anything about it. And then the question becomes, well, then what do you do? And why are we hiring you? And why are we paying money for you? So I think that this is a real opportunity for us to see how proactive and how good these offices can be with what kind of results they're getting on behalf of residents of nursing homes or assisted living facilities, or on behalf of the public when a request for assistance comes in. The request was handled, resolved within 30 days or within 20 days or within 3 days. How many requests that they had for assistance revolving around finding a facility, and how the long-term care ombudsman was able to step in and help a person find a facility to go to that would meet their needs. And there's a variety of ways that we could really use these positions, and I think that they're valuable in that respect. But the key performance measures aren't really, at this point, meeting the so what test. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wasn't actually going to speak on this today, but I feel compelled to do so.
To the bill?
To the bill. The people who came to before the subcommittee and presented their case, after all was said and done, said they could really use 4 additional positions. But they are going to double their effectiveness with this budget, and they are doing a great job right now, and I think that they are well aware of their key performance measures and as to whether they need to, what they need to do to improve those, and that said that they will do that. They do a great job, and I believe we should all support this budget. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Nathanson, do you wish to close?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, thank you. Because of some of the questions, I would like to point out a few additional pieces of information that's found from our document from the agency, from the performance measures. Key performance measure number 7 is number of requests for assistance from consumers, the public, facility staff, and agencies. And what we see in this measure is that this office for long-term care ombudsman does consultations with consumers frequently about facility placement. They do training for facility staff, for resident and family councils, and they give quite a few community presentations in addition to responding to or investigating complaints. In fact, they did 637 more than what their target had been. With response to so what, and does this agency actually do any good, I think there's a lot of belief in what the value is important for. But in addition to that, it's necessary that we do this function because it's responding to the Older Americans Act. For quite a few years, every state has been required to comply with the Older Americans Act. And so we must do this, but beyond just what we must do, we're trying to go beyond that and do even a little better. And I would like to point out that in key performance measure number 8, which is percent of customers rating their satisfaction with the agency's service,
We see that for fiscal year 2006, the overall satisfaction rate was 91%. It was the same for timeliness and accuracy. For helpfulness, it was 92%, and for expertise, rated at 93%. So it appears that they're doing a good job with regard to that performance measure. So in closing, I just want to point out that this is something Oregon must do, but beyond must do, it's something we want to do, and the agency has proposed doing an even better job of it. With this budget, we propose to increase the staff by 25%. There was discussion in the subcommittee and also in full Ways and Means that should additional funds become available, then there is interest in adding yet another position. I do recommend an aye vote on this budget.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Berger, how do you vote? Representative Berger votes aye. Representative Kotek, how do you vote? Representative Kotek votes no. Senate Bill 5525, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Scott, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I request the rules be suspended and we return to the order of courtesies.
Representative Scott requests unanimous consent that we return to the order of courtesies. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would ask the House to help join me in welcoming a group of people, 55 students from the fifth grade, here today from Knight Elementary School in Canby. The leader of the group is Teresa Gallagher. Please join me in welcoming them here today.
Welcome to the Capitol. The further courtesies. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 16, relating to hospice programs.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 16A. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, Senate Bill 16A relates to hospice centers. The first of Oregon hospices were established 30 years ago. 10 years later, there were 43 hospices in Oregon, but only three or four were certified as eligible to receive reimbursement under the five-year-old Medicare hospice benefit. In 1985, two distinct hospice organizations merged into the Oregon Hospice Association, OHA, with a mission to promote high-quality hospice and comfort care for all Oregonians. Currently, hospice programs in the state are not required to be accredited by the OHA if they are certified by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or if they are accredited by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, also known as JACO. Senate Bill 16A updates the certification process and continues Oregon's drive towards excellence in end-of-life care. It adds a new requirement that hospice centers meet both the requirements of Medicare certification and be accredited by either OHA or JACO. In addition, it adds nurse practitioners to the definition of hospice care interdisciplinary teams. Further, it establishes that a hospice program is an institution for purposes of ORS 146.100, thereby clarifying that death investigations are not required for most circumstances where hospice care is provided. Finally, it clarifies a requirement to provide hospice utilization data to OHA and adds a requirement that OHA report that data to the Department of Human Services. Oregon has been well ahead of the curve in the provision of care to dying Oregonians and their families. The state was first identified as a national leader in end-of-life care in 1998, an honor that was repeated in 2002 and 2005. Senate Bill 16A will provide additional tools to continue that tradition. I urge your support.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Cowan, do you wish to close? No, she does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Boquist, how do you vote? Representative Bruin, how do you vote? Representative Bruin votes aye. Representative Boquist votes aye. Representative Nelson, how do you vote? Representative Nelson is off the floor. Representative Esquivel, how do you vote? Representative Esquivel is off the floor. Senate Bill 16, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Before I take a recess motion, are there any announcements? Effective immediately, the Speaker has appointed the following members to a conference committee on House Bill 2342. Representative Greg McPherson, Chair. Representative Jeff Barker, Representative Andy Olson. Representative Hunt, for what purpose do you rise?
House Democrats will caucus in about 10 minutes, and Mr. Speaker, I would also request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended so Representative Flores can change her vote on Senate Bill 804. It will not change the outcome.
Representative Hunt requests unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow Representative Flores to change her vote on Senate Bill 804. Is there an objection? Seeing none, Representative Flores, how do you vote on Senate Bill 804?
Thank you. I wish to change my vote from aye to no.
Representative Flores changed her vote from aye to no.
Mr.
Representative
Speaker?
Hunt.
I would also request unanimous consent that Representative Girard be allowed to change his vote on Senate Bill 804 and will not change the outcome.
Representative Hunt requests unanimous consent that Representative Girard be allowed to change his vote on Senate Bill SB 804. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative, how do you vote?
No.
Representative Girard votes no on Senate Bill 804. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And finally, I would request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended so Representative Gilliam can change his vote on Senate Bill 804. It will also not change the outcome.
Representative Hunt requests unanimous consent that Representative Gilliam be allowed to change his vote on Senate Bill 804. Representative Gilliam, is there any objection? Hearing none. Representative Gilliam, how do you vote? Representative Gilliam votes no on Senate Bill 804. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Republicans will caucus as soon as you grab your lunch, please.
Further announcements? Representative Jensen, would you please make a recess motion until 2 p.m. today?
Mr. Speaker, I move the House stand in recess until 2 p.m. this afternoon.
And the House stands adjourned until 2 p.m. We stand in recess until 2 p.m. this afternoon. Without objection?